Boeing's long-delayed new jet, the 787, suffered another big setback last month when a fire during a test flight revealed a serious problem with the electrical system. The test planes remain grounded, and the company's production schedule is sliding yet again. As NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports, the company is still trying to come up with the precise fix.
If everything had gone as planned on the 787 program, lots of the new jets would be flying passengers around the world. But not a single airplane has been delivered. More than 2.5 years behind schedule, the plane Boeing calls the Dreamliner is still being tested. Flight tests are supposed to validate systems and reveal problems, but a flight on a Tuesday afternoon in November was far from ordinary.
The first indication the pilot had that anything was actually going wrong in the airplane was a fire indication warning, which popped up right in front of him.
John Ostrower, a well-connected and closely followed aviation writer, explains the jet was on final approach when stray debris inside an electrical panel caused a short and then a fire.
What then happened was described as a cascading series of failures.
The fire self-extinguished within 30 seconds, but according to Boeing, the plane lost primary electrical power. The system to distribute power to everything from cockpit displays to microwave ovens went haywire. While the pilots never lost control of the plane and it landed safely, Ostrower says,
this fire exposed a fundamental weakness in the systems architecture of this airplane.
It's just the latest in a long series of problems, says Richard Abulafia, an analyst with the Teal Group.
There are three things that make this aircraft unique. One, composite materials. They found all kinds of problems working with composite materials. Two, global supply and design chain. And, of course, they've had all kinds of problems. And the third is more electric aircraft. And, well, it turns out they've discovered issues with that part of the aircraft's pioneering design as well.
So how do they fix it? Boeing plans to rework the software for the power distribution system, but the company isn't offering details or even an estimate on how long that will take. Ostrower and others suggest the fix could take 4 to 6 months.
When you start unraveling software in such an integrated system where one part of the airplane depends on another part of the airplane, which depends on another part of the airplane, you get a bit of a domino effect in terms of not being able to just change one thing in isolation.
Another issue is raised by Stan Sorcer of SPIA, the Engineer and Technical Workers Union. He points to extensive outsourcing of the 787 and says it will be harder for Boeing to make changes on this jet than it would have been on its earlier airplane programs.
The problem-solving culture is much weaker. It's not so strong. There aren't teams. The suppliers own the designs. And when it comes time to develop a solution and implement it, Boeing simply doesn't have the same authority to say, this is how we're going to proceed.
Suppliers could balk. They could demand additional payments from Boeing. Meanwhile, airline customers who ordered the new jet are growing increasingly restless. On Monday, a top official for Air India said the airline will seek $840 million in compensation from Boeing. And recent reports say another carrier, China Eastern, intends to cancel all its 787 orders. Still, about 850 orders for the new model remain on Boeing's books, and the company says it continues to believe the 787 is a great airplane that will deliver outstanding value. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
The battle over WikiLeaks may be at a turning point. The site's supporters are now divided. They've long defended the group's right to free speech, but radical elements within the movement have gone further, launching cyber attacks on companies that cut ties with WikiLeaks. The U.S. government is also now conflicted. It champions internet freedom around the world, but in this case, the Obama administration is considering legal action against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange for disclosing state secrets. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
Julian Assange is fast emerging as a hero to those who think he and his organization have the right to publish the secret documents in their possession. The information future, after all, is in the digital domain.
This is the biggest free speech battle of our lifetimes.
Marsha Hoffman is a senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
This is the moment when we will see whether publishers can continue to freely distribute truthful political information online, and the extent to which they can do it.
In a speech just last January, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton seemed herself to champion this idea. Information, she pointed out, has never been so free.
There are more ways to spread more ideas to more people than at any moment in history. And even in authoritarian countries, information networks are helping people discover new facts and making governments more accountable.
But the administration is now arguing that by publishing classified reports on the internet, WikiLeaks has jeopardized national security and the exercise of diplomacy. The Department of Justice is considering legal charges against Assange. Members of Congress are calling for legislation that would make it possible to crack down on organizations like WikiLeaks. Evgeny Morozov, who blogs about the impact of the internet on global politics, wonders what should be made of Clinton's speech today.
This basic impulse to promote internet freedom abroad is contradicted by the wishes of American policymakers who don't want to see a free internet because it undermines the power of America and also threatens it in many ways. It basically makes America look very hypocritical.
That same point is now being made by Vladimir Putin in Russia, as well as by other world leaders. And reports that the U.S. government has pressured companies to cut ties with WikiLeaks has given more fuel to WikiLeaks supporters. Jean-Paul Cordell, a threat researcher at Panda Security, has been chronicling how many WikiLeaks supporters have joined in cyber attacks aimed at MasterCard and Visa, both of whom have suspended payments to WikiLeaks. These, he says, are protesters who might otherwise have been demonstrating in the street.
What I kind of attribute it to is you don't have to stand in that picket line anymore, and I think people realize that they can fight back with technology.
But this new turn in the pro-WikiLeaks movement could also be problematic. Marsha Hoffman says her organization, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is disappointed to see the hack attacks on the websites.
This is a free speech debate, and the best way to promote free speech is to continue to speak about things that you don't like. And the worst thing to do is to shut somebody else down or silence them so that they can't be part of that debate, too.
The outcome of this fight is still uncertain. Escalation by the United States and allied governments could radicalize the internet freedom movement, but confrontational tactics on the part of the WikiLeaks supporters could alienate some of those who may otherwise sympathize with them. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
You are listening to All Things Considered.
You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I am Ira Flatow. Now, I am sure that you have had one of these moments. You're driving down the highway. Your GPS is telling you, get off at the next exit. But you know that's the wrong exit. The one you really want is right after that. But that little voice keeps insisting, merge right, 100 yards, turn right. And then comes the inevitable recalibrating. Now, I don't know about you, but it gets pretty aggravating to me to the point where I've told my GPS to, let's put it mildly, to shut up, or I have threatened to swap it out for a compass. Of course, it can't understand your insults, but what if your GPS could sense when you were losing your patience and react? Maybe try to sweet talk you a little bit, like, since it seems like you know the way, I'll just sit back and let you drive. Gee, I'd like to hear that sometime. Wouldn't that be something? Well, unfortunately, the technology is not quite there yet. It's hard for computers to crack the code of your human emotion, understanding whether you're angry or sad or you're frustrated or you're happy. But my next guests have designed a program that may get us a little bit closer to that goal, a way for the computer to analyze in real time, as you're talking, what sort of mood you might be in. And my guests are they're not just any computer scientists. They're two high school juniors who are splitting a $100,000 grand prize in the Siemens competition in math and science technology. Let me introduce them to you. Matthew Fernandez is a junior at the Oregon Episcopal School in Portland. Welcome to Science Friday, Matthew.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Along with him at the school is Akash Krishnan. He's also a junior there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Let me ask you, Matthew, how did you guys ever get started on this project? What was the impetus for this idea?
Let's see, we were actually inspired by a movie entitled I, Robot. It was originally a collection of short stories by Isaac Asimov, and it was remade into a movie in the last 10 years. And we were taking a break from trying to brainstorm a science research project idea and watched this film, and we were ultimately inspired by a scene in the movie where a robot can recognize that its user is very afraid and then protects its user. And we thought, that's a really useful and really handy thing. Is there any actual science behind this kind of science fiction story? And it turns out that there is. Emotion recognition is kind of a really close topic, and we've been really fixated and passionate about it for the last year.
And so how long did it take you to actually put all of this together?
We started this project about 1 year ago. Now, we got the idea in about October, and then our first prototype was about a year ago.
And we actually, if our listeners want to go to our website at sciencefriday.com, we have a video of you actually using this. But Akash, for listeners who are driving right now, describe to us how the system works.
So the way it works is we have to train our program to recognize emotions. So we use a database, and let's say we have 100 angry files. Using these files, we extract information such as the frequency ranges, the averages of those frequencies, and energy levels for angry. And then we do this for each of the emotions we have. So we extract it for happiness and then sadness. And then using these ranges and of frequencies and energies, we can compare it to another audio signal that you're talking. And you can figure out those ranges of frequencies and energies and then compare them and try to figure out which is the best match for each of the emotions.
Mm-hmm. So did you actually use a lot of computer programming and math in making this design?
Yes, there's a lot of high-level calculus that was involved. Of course, we don't actually know most of it, but luckily there's a lot of algorithms out there that that are built into a program that we've used called MATLAB. And so basically we just use MATLAB and its functions and put them to good use for our program.
Matthew, how does your algorithm compare state-of-the-art to state-of-the-art stuff? How good is it versus what's already out there?
Our system is definitely state-of-the-art. Some of the results that we've achieved are much higher than some that other researchers have published, specifically for a contest that was actually put together for a conference in Brighton, UK called InterSpeech. It was an emotion challenge, and it was designed. And the goal was simply to create a highly accurate emotion recognition system, and our system is well above the winners of that contest.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Russell Kirsch in Portland. Hi, Russell.
Hello. When we built the first computer in America back at the National Bureau of Standards a half century ago, we all felt that nothing would be withheld from us, which we have conceived to do. And as a result, we have a whole generation of people who develop all kinds of wonderful things which we now know of as computer technology. However, today, as a result of one of the things that was constructed, namely the Internet, people feel a little differently. They now feel that nothing will be withheld from us which we decide to say or hear or read. But your guests today still know what we knew a half century ago, that anything they want to do, they can do with these powerful techniques. And so what we need is for schools to teach more students what your guests have learned, namely how to program computers, because there are magnificent things that can be done as well as just communicating with others. And so you have an excellent example of something that schools should be encouraged to do today.
Let me get a response from Matthew or Akash. How encouraging was your school? I mean, did you have mentors there who helped you?
We've been going to the same school. It's called Oregon Episcopal School. It's an independent school in Portland, and we've both been going since the lower grades. Akash joined in first grade, and I was there for kindergarten. And we've done projects together in the past, and I think that the kind of holistic approach to learning has really helped us kind of seek out some of the resources that we needed to start our project. So we did a lot of time at the beginning of our research coming up with books and internet resources, trying to help us learn how to create an emotion recognition system. And then using that information, we were kind of able to then innovate some really cool new ways to analyze emotions from human speech.
Russell, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Okay, sure.
Have a good weekend. 1-800-989-8255. What kinds of competition did you have? Was it tough competition in winning this prize?
Yeah, there's a lot of competition. In the Siemens competition, all of the other projects were in different categories, such as mathematics or there's computer science projects as well, and biological projects. And the interesting thing is they're all very different, and they're all top-notch. They're all very good. And most of the time I couldn't understand what all the other projects we're talking about, but for some of them, I could. So they're all pretty interesting.
I also find it interesting that two of the databases you use to train your algorithm were German speakers. So it doesn't matter what language that you use. You can still pick out the emotional parts.
Yeah, that's the awesome part of our program is that you can train it with any language. And as long as it's similar to the English or German culture, then our program will be able to perform at pretty much the exact same level. So any language, English or German or any languages like that, should work.
So where do you guys go from here? Do you think you have a product that you might be able to market, Matthew or Akash?
Yes, I think that we're working, in fact, on creating a specific device. We're working on a wristwatch, which would use like a smiley face, a sad face, angry face on the wristwatch, and that would show an autistic child what emotions are being spoken. Autism is a disease which can often lead to children especially having a very difficult time recognizing the emotions that are being spoken to them. And so this wristwatch could have the potential to significantly improve their ability to interact with their peers or to communicate in general. And we're really fixated on creating this device.
Was this at the beginning, in your mind, at the beginning of your project, or something that you developed an idea for later on?
This was developed later. We came up with this over the last summer. We spent the summer working at a local university called Oregon Health and Science University, and there's a lot of research there on autism, and so people there suggested that we consider applying our research towards helping autistic children.
And what kind of computing power? How big, powerful a computer do you need to run your system?
Our system actually can be run on just a simple PC, and so we both used personal laptops for our research, and we haven't used really big supercomputers or anything too exciting. In fact, we're looking at creating perhaps something like an iPhone app, which uses less processing power, but we'd have to redesign our system to accommodate that.
It looked like it might also be useful in video gaming, perhaps.
Yes, I think so. I think that gaming is moving towards a place where you can interact more and more. And now with the new Xbox Kinect system, where you can wave at your TV and it'll follow your movements, things like that. I think that if you can start talking and interacting with your TV or your games, I think that just gives you another human connection.
Yeah,
it could be really cool.
Yeah, it also gives you something else to learn how to be angry. How do you wave at your TV or your screen and decipher how much waving it takes to show anger or whatever kind of emotion?
Exactly.
Have you guys started thinking about college yet, being juniors in high school? Where you want to go? And are you thinking about following up on your careers in computing?
Yeah, I plan on learning computer science and electrical engineering. And we don't really have a list, or at least I don't have a list of colleges I want to go to, but there are all the top schools that, of course, that such as MIT or Stanford or Carnegie Mellon University, but not really a big list.
And you, Matthew?
Yeah, I'm really excited about we're continuing our research into the next year, trying to improve our results even further. And I think that potentially where we go to college may be affected by the kind of interest that universities receive related to our research.
Well, you never know. There are a few professors listening. We have over a million people listening, so maybe somebody's got an offer for you out there after they hear about your research. Have you been doing a lot of publicity on this? Have you found a lot of interest in your work?
Yes, we have. We, in fact, earlier in May, got contacted by someone from the government to the military to start perhaps using some of our stuff for military applications, specifically like teaching humans how to recognize the emotions in other languages,
the
language training.
Right.
But also from industry, there's been some interest, and I think that this kind of getting to appear on National Public Radio is another big step towards getting us more connections.
Well, good luck to you. Good luck in your college careers and in your computing life.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Matthew Fernandez and Akash Krishnan, both of Oregon Episcopal School in Portland, were the grand prize, $100,000. Gee, we didn't get to ask them what they're going to do. $100,000 from the Siemens Competition in Math, Science, and Technology. Stay with us. We're going to switch gears and bring on Isabella Rossellini. She'll be with us to talk about sex and animals. You'll have to stay by to see what I'm talking about. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.
Now to China, where authorities have been actively blocking coverage of today's Nobel ceremony and clamping down on dissidents. NPR's Rob Gifford joins us from Shanghai. And Rob, if you wanted to follow today's news and the ceremony, could you?
Well, you could follow the government propaganda condemning it, but if you wanted to get anything else, it'd be very difficult indeed. There has been a bit of a buzz on the internet in some of the chat rooms, but often they get deleted as fast as those comments can be put up. The international broadcasts, CNN and BBC, have been blocked. They were blocked at the exact time that the Nobel ceremony started, so it really has been across the board here.
And Rob, as we mentioned, at the same time, a widespread crackdown on dissidents. What are you hearing?
Well, that's right. Even people I have spoken to in the last few days have been taken away from their homes. Previously, they were being kept under house arrest, as indeed Liu Xiaobo's wife was and still is. The weird thing about all this, combining these two issues, though, is that by having this response, the Chinese government has provoked an interest in Liu Xiaobo, which was not there before. Previously, no one had even heard of him. And now, you can be sure, some people will believe the government propaganda that it's an anti-Chinese, Western-organized plot, but others will be searching out Liu Xiaobo's political writings for the first time.
Okay, Rob, thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
It's NPR's Rob Gifford in Shanghai talking about China's response to today's awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize in absentia to Liu Xiaobo.
Major American companies may indeed have more freedom than the government to act against WikiLeaks and against other speech they don't like, NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
MasterCard, Visa, and PayPal all stopped accepting donations to WikiLeaks. Jennifer Stalzer of MasterCard says the situation was just too sticky.
Given the serious nature of allegations and broad concerns raised by many regarding the activities of this organization, we believe it was prudent to suspend acceptance, and that's what we've done.
PayPal just said WikiLeaks might be encouraging illegal behavior, and that violated PayPal's acceptable use policy. Amazon pointed to its terms of service agreement when it threw WikiLeaks off its servers. But Clay Shirky, who teaches in the Interactive Telecommunications Program at NYU, thinks terms of service agreements give companies too much power.
Every corp council at every large organization is basically paid to write a web terms of service, which reads, "We can do anything at any time for no reason with no announcement and no recourse."
If you have ever signed up for any web service, PayPal, Facebook, Amazon, iTunes, Twitter, Gmail, the list goes on, you have accepted a terms of service agreement.
We get a world where basically if you can make any kind of speech just be too much of a hassle, it can be taken off the internet.
Shirky says a perfect example are the hackers who support WikiLeaks and call themselves Anonymous. They were using Twitter and Facebook to organize denial-of-service attacks against PayPal, Visa, MasterCard, and Amazon. Twitter and Facebook just shut down their accounts. Tim Wu, a professor of law at Columbia, thinks Twitter is hypocritical because it permitted Iranian activists to plan on their site, but not WikiLeaks supporters.
There are people who should demand of Twitter, "What are you doing? Since when are you in the business of deciding who and who isn't a good civil disobedience movement?"
Marsha Hoffman says it's not just corporations trying to shut people up.
What we're seeing right now are a lot of situations in which people are simply trying to silence speech that they don't like on all sides.
Hoffman is an attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a civil rights group. They condemn the anonymous hackers who support WikiLeaks for attacking the websites of Amazon, PayPal, Visa, and MasterCard. So the anonymous hackers turned around and attacked the Electronic Frontier Foundation website. So far, the structure of the internet continues to make it hard for anyone to really censor anyone else, says Columbia professor Tim Wu.
You can make it hard for them to get money, and you can make it hard for them to get web server space. So you can basically be ostracized but not destroyed.
WikiLeaks now has a server in Switzerland. The hackers who call themselves anonymous have found other places online to organize. But as private companies like Facebook and Twitter become the dominant online forums, their ability to shut out speech may have a larger impact on public dialogue. Wu and other observers do worry that keeping the internet open isn't going to be easy. In countries like China, it's the government that limits access to content online. In the U.S., it's becoming more common for private companies to do the censoring. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
There are also lots of high-tech goodies for the foodies on your family and friends' gift lists. Weekend Edition commentator Bonnie Wolf has these suggestions.
Remember menu planning? You take down a bunch of cookbooks, plan the week's meals, and make a shopping list on paper. All you need today is your smartphone. There are hundreds of thousands of web applications called apps, and a lot of them deal with food. Many are free, but some cost a few bucks. Today's menu planning probably starts with something like Mise en Place, a $3 app that centers around organizing prep tasks like brining the chicken or making stock. One of the most popular recipe apps is Epicurious, with its 28,000 recipes from Gourmet and Bon Appetit. So if you find Jerusalem artichokes at the market, type it in and you'll get 30 recipes to consider. And it's free. There are loads of recipe sites, including several by celebrity chefs, Jamie Oliver's 20-Minute Meals, Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything. There's even help for the night you open the refrigerator and find only sardines and rice from last night's carryout. Open the Ultimate Recipe Search Tool app and see what it suggests doing with those ingredients. I did it and got something called Sloppy Sardines. With Ratio, you can do away with recipes altogether. This app gives ratios for food fundamentals. A batter ratio is equal parts liquid and flour and half that much egg. Then the app calculates how much of each ingredient you need. So, if you remember to bring your phone, you can whip up a batch of biscuits around the campfire. Locavore lets you know what's in season and where the closest farmer's market is. Then the Harvest app can help you choose what's freshest and ripest. Happy Cow lists vegetarian and vegan stores and restaurants, while Ask the Butcher has diagrams showing different cuts of meat and how to cook them. Parrot matches food with wine. If you want to impress your date, pull up Hello Vino to make it look like you really know whether to order a Zinfandel or a Malbec. For dining out, the Yelp app has user restaurant reviews. Zagat's gives you 45 cities, and if you shake your phone using Urban Spoon, a slot machine image comes up with choices in price, location, and type of food. Where are the food trucks? There's an app for that. What's the Wait gives the waiting time at your favorite restaurant. You know all those people taking pictures of their food at restaurants? Some may be for Food Spotting, an app with photos and ratings of good food. There are apps for restaurant menus, calculating tips, food substitutes, counting calories. Now, if only these phones were smart enough to do the dishes.
Bonnie Wolf is author of Talking with My Mouthful and editor of NPR's Kitchen Window. This is NPR News.